Saiki, there's something I have to ask you. Something personal.
Yes.
And maybe out of line, too. But it's important. For me it is. She puts the pen back on the desk, and her eyes fill with a kind of neutral glow. All right. Go ahead. Do you have any children? She takes a breath and pauses. The expression on her face slowly retreats somewhere far away, then comes back. A bit like a parade that disappears down a street, then marches back on the same street towards you again. Why do you want to know that? It's personal. It's not just some spur-of-the-moment question. She lifts her thick Mont Blanc like she's testing the thickness and heft of it, then sets it on the desk and looks up. I'm sorry, but I can't give you a yes or no answer. At least right now. I'm tired, and there's a strong wind blowing. I nod. Sorry, I shouldn't have asked. It's all right. I'm not blaming you, she says gently. Thank you for the coffee. You make excellent coffee. I leave and go back down the stairs to my room. I sit on my bed and try to read, but nothing seems to filter into my head. I feel as if I'm gazing at some table of random numbers, just following the words with my eyes. I put my book down, go to the window, and look at the garden. There are birds on some of the branches, but no wind to speak of. Am I in love with Miss Saiki when she was 15? Or with the real 50-something Miss Saiki upstairs? I don't know anymore. The boundary line separating the two has started to waver, to fade, and I can't focus. And that confuses me. I close my eyes and try to find some center inside to hold on to. But you know she's right. Every single day, each time I see her face, see her, it's utterly precious.
28. For a man his age, Colonel Sanders was light on his feet, and so fast that he resembled a veteran speedwalker. And he seemed to know every nook and cranny of the city. He took shortcuts up dark, narrow staircases, turning sideways to squeeze through the narrow passages between houses. He leapt over a ditch, hushing a barking dog behind a hedge with a short command. Like some restless spirit searching for its home, his small, white-suited figure raced through the back alleyways of the town. It was all Hoshino could do to keep up. He was soon out of breath, his armpits soaked. Colonel Sanders never once looked behind him to see if he was following. "Hey, are we almost there?" Hoshino called out impatiently. "What are you talking about, young fella? I wouldn't even call this a walk," Colonel Sanders replied, still not turning. "Yeah, but I'm a customer, remember? What's going to happen to my sex drive if I'm worn out? What a disgrace! And you call yourself a man? If a little walk's going to kill your desire, you might as well not have any to start with." "Jeez!" Hoshino muttered. Colonel Sanders cut across another side street, crossed a main road oblivious to the traffic light, and continued walking. He strode across a bridge and ducked into a shrine. A fairly big shrine by the looks of it, but it was late and no one else was around. Colonel Sanders pointed to a bench in front of the shrine office, indicating that Hoshino should take a seat. A mercury lamp was next to the bench, and everything was as bright as day. Hoshino did as he was told, and Colonel Sanders sat down next to him. "You're not going to make me do it here, are you?" Hoshino asked anxiously. "Don't be an idiot. We're not like those deer that hang around the famous shrines and go at it. I'm not about to have you do it in a shrine. Who do you think I am, anyway?" Then he extracted a silver mobile phone from his pocket and punched in a 3-digit number. "Yeah, it's me," he said when the other person answered. "The usual place, the shrine. I've got a young man named Hoshino here with me." "That's right. The same as usual." "Yes, I got it. Just get here as soon as you can." He switched off the phone and slipped it back into the pocket of his white suit. "Do you always call up the girls from the shrine?" Hoshino asked. "Anything wrong with that?" "No, not really. I was just thinking there's got to be a better place. Someplace more normal. A coffee shop, or maybe have me wait in a hotel room. A shrine's quiet, and the air's crisp and clean." "True, but waiting for a girl on a bench in front of a shrine office, it's hard to relax. I feel as if I'm going to fall under the spell of one of those fox spirits or something." "What are you talking about? You're not making fun of Chicago now, are you? Takamatsu's a proper city. The prefectural capital, in fact. Not some backwater. We don't have any foxes here." "Okay, okay, just kidding. But you're in the service industry, so I was just thinking you should worry more about creating an atmosphere. You know what I'm saying? Something luxurious to get you in the mood." "I don't know. Maybe it's none of my business." "You're right. It isn't," Colonel Sanders intoned. "Now, about that stone."
"Right, the stone. Tell me about it."
"After you do the deed, then we talk."
"Doing the deed's important, eh?"
Colonel Sanders nodded gravely a couple of times, tugging at his goatee. "That's right. It's a formality you have to go through. Then we'll talk about the stone.
I know you're going to like this girl. She's our top girl. Luscious breasts, skin like silk, a nice curvy waist, hot and wet right where you like it, a regular sex machine. To use a car metaphor, she's four-wheel drive in bed, turbocharged desire. Step on the accelerator, the surging gear stick in her hands. You round the corner, she shifts gears ecstatically, you race out in the fast lane and bang, you're there. Hoshino's dead and gone to heaven."
"You're quite a character, you know that," Hoshino said admiringly. "As I said, I'm not in this business for my health." 15 minutes later, the girl arrived, and Colonel Sanders was right. She was a knockout. Tight miniskirt, black high heels, a small black enamel shoulder bag. She could easily have been a model. Generous breasts, too, spilling out of her low-cut top.
"Will she do?"
Colonel Sanders asked. Hoshino was too stunned to reply, and simply nodded.
"A veritable sex machine, Hoshino. Have yourself a ball,"
Colonel Sanders said, smiling for the first time. He gave Hoshino a pinch on the rump. The girl led Hoshino to a nearby love hotel, where she filled up the bathtub, quickly slipped out of her clothes, and then undressed him. She washed him carefully all over, then commenced to lick him, sliding into a totally artistic act of fellatio, doing things to him he'd never seen or heard of in his life. He couldn't think of anything else but coming, and come he did.
"Man alive, that was fantastic. I've never felt like that,"
Hoshino said, languidly sinking back into the hot tub.
"That's just the beginning," the girl said. "Wait till you see what's next."
"Yeah, but man, that was good."
"How good?"
"Like there's no past or future anymore.
The pure present is an ungraspable advance of the past devouring the future. In truth, all sensation is already memory."
Hoshino looked up, mouth half open, and gazed at her face.
"What's that?"
"Henri Bergson," she replied, licking the semen from the tip of his penis.
"Mamemole."
"Pardon?" "Matter of memory. You ever read it?"
"I don't think so,"
Hoshino replied after a moment's thought. Except for the special STF driver's manual he was forced to study, and the books on Shikoku history he'd just gone through at the library, he couldn't remember reading anything except manga.
"Have you read it?" The girl nodded. "I had to. I'm studying philosophy at college, and we have exams coming up."
"You don't say," Hoshino said. "So this is a part-time job, to help pay tuition."
She took him over to the bed, stroked him all over with her fingertips and tongue, getting another erection out of him. A firm hard-on, a Tower of Pisa at carnival time.
"See, you're ready to go again,"
the girl remarked, slowly segueing into her next set of motions.
"Any special requests?
something you'd like me to do? Mr. Sanders asked me to make sure you got everything you wanted.
I can't think of anything special, but could you quote some more of that philosophy stuff? I don't know why, but it might keep me from coming so quickly. Otherwise I'll lose it pretty fast. Let's see. This is fairly old, but how about some Hegel? Whatever. I recommend Hegel. He's somewhat out of date, but definitely an oldie but goodie. Sounds good to me. At the same time that I am the content of a relation, I am also that which does the relating. Hegel believed that a person is not merely conscious of self and object as separate entities, but through the projection of the self via the mediation of the object, is volitionally able to gain a deeper understanding of the self, all of which constitutes self-consciousness.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, think of what I'm doing to you right now. For me, I'm the self, and you're the object. For you, of course, it's the exact opposite. You're the self to you, and I'm the object. And by exchanging self and object, we can project ourselves onto the other and gain self-consciousness volitionally.
I still don't get it, but it sure feels good.
That's the whole idea, the girl said.
Afterwards, he said goodbye to the girl and returned to the shrine, where Colonel Sanders was sitting on the bench just as he'd left him.
You've been sitting here all this time?
Hoshino asked.
Colonel Sanders shook his head irritably. Don't be a moron. Do I look like I have that much time on my hands? While you were sailing off to heaven, I was working the back alleys again. She called me when you finished, and I rushed over. So, how was our little sex machine?
Pretty good, I'll bet.
She was great. No complaints. I got off 3 times, volitionally speaking. I must have lost 5 pounds.
Glad to hear it. Now, about the stone.
Right, that's what I came for.
Actually, the stone's in the woods right here in this shrine.
We're talking about the entrance stone?
That's right, the entrance stone.
Are you sure you're not just making this up?
Colonel Sanders' head shot up.
What are you talking about, you dingbat? Have I ever lied to you? Do I just make things up? I told you I'd get you a supple young sex machine, and I kept my end of the bargain. At a bargain basement price, too. Only 15,000 yen, and you were brazen enough to shoot off 3 times, no less. All that, and you still doubt me?
Don't blow a fuse. Of course I believe you. It's just that when things are going along a little too smoothly, I get a bit suspicious, that's all. I mean, think about it. I'm walking along, and a guy in a funny get-up calls out to me, tells me he knows where to find the stone, then I go with him and get off with this drop-dead gorgeous babe.
3 times?
Whatever. So I get off 3 times, and then you tell me the stone I'm looking for is right over there? Well, that would confuse anybody.
You still don't get it, do you? We're talking about a revelation here, Colonel Sanders said, clicking his tongue. A revelation leaps over the borders of the everyday. A life without revelation is no life at all. What you need to do is move from reason that observes to reason that acts. That's what's critical. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about, you gold-plated whale of a dunce?
The projection and exchange between self and object? Hoshino timidly began.
Good! I'm glad you know that much, at least. That's the point. Follow me, and you can pay your respects to your precious stone. A special package deal, just for you.
29. I call up Sakura from the public phone in the library. I realize I haven't been in touch once since that night at her place. Just a short note, and that was it. I'm kind of embarrassed about the way I said goodbye. After I left her apartment, I went straight to the library, and Oshima drove me up to the cabin for a few days, well out of range of any phone. Then I came to live and work at the library, encountering Miss Sayaki's living spirit, or something like it, every night. And I've fallen head over heels for that 15-year-old girl. A ton of things happened, one after another. Enough to keep anybody busy. Not that that's any excuse. It's around 9 p.m. when I call, and she answers after 6 rings. "Where in the world have you been?" Sakura asks in a hard voice. "I'm still in Takamatsu." She doesn't say anything for a while. In the background, I hear a music program on TV. "Somehow I've survived," I add. Silence, then a kind of resigned sigh. "What did you mean by disappearing like that? I was worried about you, so I came home a little early that day, even did some shopping for us. I know it was wrong, I do, but I had to leave. My mind was all messed up, and I had to get away to think things out, try to get back on my feet. Being with you was, I don't know, I can't put it into words."
"Overstimulating?"
"Yeah. I've never been near a girl like that before. No kidding. You know, the scent of a girl. All kinds of things. Pretty rough being young, eh?" "I guess," I say. "So how's your job going? It's been a madhouse, but I wanted to work and save up some money, so I shouldn't complain." I pause, then tell her about the police looking for me. She's silent for a while, then cautiously says, "That business with the blood." I decide to hold back on telling the truth. "No, that's not it. Nothing about the blood. They're looking for me because I'm a runaway. They want to catch me and ship me back to Tokyo, that's all. So they might get in touch with you. The other day, the night I stayed over, I called your mobile phone using mine, and they traced the phone records and found that I was here in Takamatsu." "Don't worry," she says. "It's a prepaid phone, so there's no way they can trace it to me." "That's a relief," I say. "I didn't want to cause you any more trouble than I already have." "You're so sweet. You're going to make me cry, you know that." "No, that's how I truly feel."
"I know,"
she says as if she'd rather not admit it. "So where's our little runaway staying these days?" "Somebody I know is letting me stay."
"Since when do you know anybody here?"
How could I possibly summarize everything that's happened to me in the past few days? "It's a long story," I say. "With you, it's always long stories." "I don't know why, but it always turns out that way."
"Sort of a tendency of yours?"
"I guess so," I reply. "I'll tell you all about it someday, when I have the time. It's not like I'm hiding anything. I just can't explain it well over the phone."
"That's okay.
I just hope you're not into anything you shouldn't be."
"No, it's nothing like that. I'm okay, don't worry."
She sighs again.
"I can understand wanting to be out on your own, but just don't get mixed up with anything illegal, okay? It isn't worth it. I don't want to see you die some miserable teenage death like Billy the Kid."
"Billy the Kid didn't die in his teens," I correct her. "He killed 21 people and died when he was 21.
"If you say so. Anyway, was there something you wanted?"
"I just wanted to thank you. I feel bad about leaving like that after you were so nice."
"Thanks, but why don't we just forget that, okay?"
"I wanted to hear your voice too," I say.
"I'm happy to hear that. But how does that help anything?"
"I don't know how to put it exactly. This might sound strange, but you're living in the real world, breathing real air, speaking real words.
Talking to you makes me feel, for the time being, connected to reality, and that's really important to me now."
"The people you're with now aren't?"
"I'm not sure," I tell her.
"So what you're saying is that you're in some unreal place with people cut off from reality?"
I think about that for a while.
"You might say that."
"Kafka," Sakura says, "I know it's your life, and I shouldn't interfere, but I think you'd better get out of there. I don't know what kind of place you're in, but I get the feeling that's the smart move. Call it a hunch. Why don't you come to my place? You can stay as long as you like." Why are you so nice to me? What are you, a dunce? What do you mean? 'Cause I like you. Can't you work that out? I'm basically a curious type. But I wouldn't do this for just anybody. I've done all this for you because I like you, okay? I don't know how to put it, but you feel like a younger brother to me. I hold the phone without saying a word. For a second, I'm completely confused, even dizzy. Nobody's ever said anything like that to me. Ever. You still there? Sakura asks. Yeah, I manage to say. Well then, say something. I stand up straight and take a deep breath. Sakura, I wish I could do that. I really do. But I can't right now. Like I told you, I can't leave here. I'm in love. With some complicated, unreal person. You could say that. I hear her sigh again. A deep, profound kind of sigh. You know, when kids your age fall in love, they tend to get a little spacey. So if the person you're in love with isn't connected to reality, that's a major problem. You follow me? Yeah, I get it. Kafka? Hmm? If anything happens, call me, okay? Don't hesitate at all. I appreciate it. I hang up. Go back to my room. Put the single of Kafka on the Shore on the turntable and lower the needle. And once more, whether I like it or not, I'm swept away to that place, to that time. I sense a presence and open my eyes. It's dark. The fluorescent numbers on the alarm clock next to my bed show it's after 3. I must have fallen asleep. In the faint light from the lamppost in the garden, I see her sitting there. As ever, she's at the desk, gazing at the painting on the wall, motionless, head in her hands. And I'm lying in bed, trying hard not to breathe, eyes barely open, gazing at her silhouette. Outside the window, the breeze from the sea is rustling the branches of the dogwood. After a while, though, I sense that something's different. Something in the air that disturbs the perfect harmony of our little world. I strain to see through the gloom. What is it? The wind momentarily picks up, and the blood coursing through my veins begins to feel strangely thick and heavy. The dogwood branches draw a nervous maze on the window pane. Finally, it comes to me. The silhouette isn't that of the young girl. It looks a lot like her, almost an exact match. But it isn't exactly the same. More a copy of a drawing laid over the real thing. Some of the details are off. Her hairstyle is different, for one thing. And she has on different clothes. Her whole presence is different. Unconsciously, I shake my head. It isn't the girl sitting there. It's someone else. Something's happening. Something very important. I'm clutching my hands tight beneath the covers, and my heart, unable to stand it anymore, starts pounding hard, beating out an unexpected, erratic rhythm. As if that sound were a signal, the silhouette in the chair begins to move. Very slowly, changing its angle like a massive ship changing course. She takes her head out of her hands and turns in my direction. With a start, I realize it's Miss Saiki. I gulp and can't let my breath out. It's the Miss Saiki of the present. The real Miss Saiki. She looks at me for a while, quietly concentrating as when she's looking at the painting. And a thought hits me. The axis of time. Somewhere I don't know about, something weird is happening to time. Reality and dreams are all mixed up, like seawater and river water flowing together. I struggle to find the meaning behind it all, but nothing makes any sense.
At last, she gets to her feet and comes towards me, holding herself as erect as she always does. She's barefoot, and the floorboards creak faintly as she walks. Without a word, she sits down on the edge of the bed and remains still for a time. Her body has a definite density and weight. She has on a white silk blouse and a navy blue skirt that comes to her knees. She reaches out and touches my head, her fingers groping through my short hair. The hand is real, with real fingers touching me. She stands up again, and in the faint light shining in from outside, as if it's the most natural thing to do, begins to undress. She's in no hurry, but she doesn't hesitate either. In smooth, natural motions, she unbuttons her blouse, slips off her skirt, and steps out of her panties. Piece by piece, her clothing falls to the floor, the soft fabric hardly making a sound. She's asleep, I realize. Her eyes are open, but it's like she's sleepwalking. Once she's naked, she crawls into the narrow bed and wraps her pale arms around me. Her warm breath grazes my neck, her pubic hair pushing up against my thigh. She must be thinking I'm her dead boyfriend from long ago, and that she's doing what they used to do here in this very room. Fast asleep, dreaming, she goes through the motions from long ago. I think that I'd better wake her up. She's making a terrible mistake, and I have to let her know. This isn't a dream. It's real life. But everything's happening so fast, and I don't have the strength to resist. Thrown totally off balance, I feel as if I'm being sucked into a time warp. And you're sucked into a time warp. Before you know it, her dream has wrapped itself around your mind, gently, warmly like amniotic fluid. Miss Saiki will take off your t-shirt, pull off your boxers. She'll kiss your neck over and over, then reach out and hold your penis, which is already porcelain hard. Gently she wraps her hand around your balls and wordlessly guides your fingers to her pubic hair. Her vagina is warm and wet. She kisses your chest, sucking your nipples. Your fingers are slowly sucked inside her. Where does your responsibility begin here? Wiping away the nebula from your sight, you struggle to find where you really are. You're trying to find the direction of the flow, struggling to hold on to the axis of time. But you can't locate the borderline separating dream and reality, or even the boundary between what's real and what's possible. All you're sure of is that you're in a delicate position. Delicate and dangerous. You're pulled along, a part of it, unable to pin down the principles of prophecy or of logic. Like when a river overflows, washing over a town, all road signs have sunk beneath the waves, and all you can see are the anonymous roofs of the sunken houses. You're face up, and Miss Saiki gets on top of you. She guides your rock-hard cock inside her. You're helpless. She's the one who does the choosing. She bends and twists her waist, as if tracing a picture with her body. Her straight hair falls on your shoulders and trembles noiselessly, like the branches of a willow. Little by little, you're sucked down into the warm mud. The whole world turns warm, wet, indistinct, and all that exists is your rigid, glistening cock. You close your eyes, and your own dream begins. It's hard to tell how much time is passing. The tide comes in, the moon rises, and soon you come. There's nothing you can do to stop it. You come over and over inside her. The warm walls inside her contract, gathering in your semen. All this while she's still asleep, with her eyes wide open. She's in a different world, and that's where your seed goes, swallowed into a place apart. A long time passes. I can't move. Every part of me is paralyzed. Paralyzed, or else maybe I just don't feel like trying to move. She gets off me and lies down beside me. After a while, she gets up, tugs on her panties, pulls on her skirt, and buttons up her blouse. She gently reaches out again and tousles my hair. All this takes place without a word passing between us. She hasn't said a thing since she entered the room. The only sounds are the creak of the floorboards, the wind blowing ceaselessly outside, the room breathing out, the windowpane shivering. That's the chorus behind me. Still asleep, she crosses the room and leaves. The door's open just a crack, but she slips right out like a delicate, dreamy fish. Silently, the door closes. I watch from the bed as she makes her exit, still unable to move. I can't even raise a finger. My lips are tightly sealed. Words are asleep in a corner of time. Unable to move a muscle, I lie there straining to hear. I imagine I'll catch the roar of her golf in the car park. But I never hear it, no matter how long I listen. The wind blows clouds over, then scatters them away. The branches of the dogwood quiver, and countless knives flash in the darkness. The window is my heart's window. The door, my soul's door. I lie there awake until dawn, staring at the empty chair.
30. The two of them scrambled over the low hedge into the woods. Colonel Sanders took a small torch out of his pocket and illuminated the narrow path. The woods weren't very deep, but the trees were hugely ancient, the tangle of their branches looming darkly above. A strong, grassy odor came from the ground below. Colonel Sanders took the lead, for once maintaining a leisurely pace. Shining the torch to make sure of his footing, he took one cautious step at a time. Hoshino followed right behind.
"Hey, Yunk, is this some kind of dare or something?" he said to the colonel's white back.
"Whoa, a ghost! Why don't you zip it for a change?" Colonel Sanders said without turning round.
"Okay, okay."
Hoshino suddenly wondered how Nakata was doing. Probably still sound asleep. It was as if the term sound asleep was invented just to describe him. Once he falls asleep, that's it. What kind of dreams does he have, though, during those record-breaking sleeps? Hoshino couldn't imagine.
"Are we there yet?"
"Almost,"
Colonel Sanders replied.
"Tell me something," Hoshino began.
"What?"
"Are you really Colonel Sanders?"
Colonel Sanders cleared his throat.
"Not really. I'm just taking on his appearance for a time."
"That's what I thought," Hoshino said.
"So what are you, really?"
"I don't have a name."
"How do you get along with that one?"
"No problem. Basically, I don't have a name or a shape."
"So you're kind of like a fart?"
"You could say that. Since I don't have a shape, I can become anything I want."
"Huh.
This time I decided to take on a familiar shape, that of a famous capitalist icon. I was toying with the idea of Mickey Mouse, but Disney in particular about the rights to their characters."
"I don't think I want Mickey Mouse pimping for me anyway."
"I see your point.
Dressing up like Colonel Sanders fits your character, too." but I don't have a character, or any feelings. Shape I may take, converse I may, but neither God nor Buddha am I. Rather an insensate being whose heart thus differs from that of man.
What the? A line from Ueda Akinari's Tales of Moonlight and Rain. I doubt you've read it.
You got me there.
I'm appearing here in human form, but I'm neither God nor Buddha. My heart works differently from humans because I don't have any feelings. That's what it means.
Hoshino said. I'm not sure I follow, but what you're saying is you're not a person and not a god or Buddha either, right?
Neither god nor Buddha, just the insensate. As such, of the good and bad of man, I neither inquire nor follow.
Meaning?
Since I'm neither god nor Buddha, I don't need to judge whether people are good or evil. Likewise, I don't have to act according to standards of good and evil.
In other words, you exist beyond good and evil.
You're too kind. I'm not beyond good and evil, exactly. They just don't matter to me. I have no idea what's good or what's evil. I'm a very pragmatic being, a neutral object, as it were, and all I care about is consummating the function I've been given to perform.
Consummate your function? What's that?
Didn't you go to school?
Yeah, I went to high school, but it was a trade school. I spent all my time screwing around on motorcycles.
I'm kind of an overseer, supervising something to make sure it fulfills its original role, checking the correlation between different worlds, making sure things are in the right order. So results follow causes and meanings don't get all mixed up. So the past comes before the present, the future after it. Things can get a little out of order, that's okay, nothing's perfect. If the account book's basically in balance, though, that's fine by me. To tell you the truth, I'm not much of a detailed person. The technical term for it is abbreviating sensory processing of continuous information, but I don't want to get into all that. It'd take too long to explain, and I know it's beyond you. So let's cut to the chase. What I'm getting at is I'm not going to complain about each and every little thing. Of course, if the accounts don't eventually balance, that is a problem. I do have my responsibility to consider.
I got a question for you. If you're such an important person, how come you're a pimp in a back alley in Takamatsu?
I am not a person, okay? How many times do I have to tell you?
Have it your way.
Pimping's just a means of getting you here. There's something I need you to lend me a hand with. So as a reward, I thought I'd let you have a good time first. A kind of formality we have to go through.
Lend you a hand?
As I've explained, I don't have any form. I'm a metaphysical, conceptual object. I can take on any form, but I lack substance, and to perform a real act, I need someone with substance to help out.
And at this particular point, that substance happens to be me.
Exactly, Colonel Sanders replied.
They cautiously continued down the path, and came to a smaller shrine beneath a thick oak tree. The shrine was old and dilapidated, with no offerings or decorations of any kind. Colonel Sanders shined his torch on it.
The stone's inside there. Open the door.
No way, Hoshino replied. You're not supposed to open up shrines whenever you feel like it. You'll be cursed. Your nose will fall off. Or your ears or something.
Not to worry. I said it's all right, so go ahead and open it. You won't be cursed. Your nose and ears won't fall off. God, you can be really old-fashioned.
Then why don't you open it? I don't want to get mixed up in that.
How many times do I have to explain this? I told you already I don't have substance. I am an abstract concept. I can't do anything on my own. That's why I went to the trouble of dragging you out here and letting you do it 3 times at a discount rate.
Yeah, man, she was fantastic. But robbing a shrine? No way. My grandfather always told me not to mess with shrines. He was really strict about it.
Forget about your grandfather. Don't lay all your Gifu Prefecture country bumpkin morality on me, okay? We don't have time for that.
Grumbling all the while, Hoshino hesitantly opened the door of the shrine, and Colonel Sanders shone his torch inside. Sure enough, there was an old round stone inside. Just like Nakata said, it was about the size of a big rice cake, a smooth white stone.
This is it? Hoshino asked.
That's right, Colonel Sanders said. Take it out.
Hold on a minute. That's stealing. No matter. Nobody's going to notice if a stone like this is missing, and nobody'll care.
Yeah, but the stone is owned by God, right? He's going to be pissed off if we take it out.
Colonel Sanders folded his arms and stared straight at Hoshino.
What is God?
The question threw Hoshino for a moment. Colonel Sanders pressed him further.
What does God look like, and what does he do?
Don't ask me. God's God. He's everywhere, watching what we do, judging whether it's good or bad.
Sounds like a football referee.
Sort of, I guess.
So God wears shorts, has a whistle sticking out of his mouth, and keeps an eye on the clock?
You know that's not what I mean, Hoshino said.
Are the Japanese god and the foreign god relatives, or maybe enemies?
How should I know?
Listen, God only exists in people's minds. Especially in Japan, God's always been kind of a flexible concept. Look at what happened after the war. Douglas MacArthur ordered the Divine Emperor to quit being God, and he did, making a speech saying he was just an ordinary person. So after 1946, he wasn't God anymore. That's what Japanese gods are like. They can be tweaked and adjusted. Some American chomping on a cheap pipe gives the order, and presto changeo, God's no longer God. A very postmodern kind of thing. If you think God's there, he is. If you don't, he isn't. And if that's what God's like, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
Anyway, just get the stone out, would you? I'll take full responsibility. I might not be a god or a Buddha, but I do have a few connections. I'll make sure you're not cursed.
You sure?
I won't go back on my word.
Hoshino reached out and carefully, as if he were inching out a landmine, picked up the stone.
It's pretty heavy. This isn't tofu we're dealing with. Stones tend to be heavy.
But even for a stone it's heavy, Hoshino said. So what do you want me to do with it?
Take it home and put it next to your bed. After that, things will take their course.
You want me to take it back to the inn?
You can get a taxi if it's too heavy, Colonel Sanders replied.
Yeah, but is it okay to take it so far?
Listen, every object's in flux. The earth, time, concepts, love, life, faith, justice, evil, they're all fluid and in transition. They don't stay in one form or in one place forever. The whole universe is like some big FedEx box. This stone's temporarily there in the form of a stone. Moving it isn't going to change anything.
All right, but what's so special about this stone? It doesn't look like much of anything.
The stone itself is meaningless. The situation calls for something, and at this point in time it just happens to be this stone. Anton Chekhov put it best when he said, "If a pistol appears in a story, eventually it's got to be fired." Do you know what he meant?
Nope.
Colonel Sanders sighed.
I didn't think so, but I had to ask. It's the polite thing to do.
Much obliged.
What Chekhov was getting at is this. Necessity is an independent concept. It has a different structure from logic, morals, or meaning. Its function lies entirely in the role it plays. What doesn't play a role shouldn't exist. What necessity requires does need to exist. That's what you call dramaturgy. Logic, morals, or meaning don't have anything to do with it. It's all a question of relationality. Chekhov understood dramaturgy very well.
Whoa, you're way over my head.
The stone you're carrying there is Chekhov's pistol. It will have to be fired, so in that sense it's important. But there's nothing sacred or holy about it, so don't worry yourself about any curse. Hoshino frowned. This stone's a pistol. Only in the metaphorical sense. Don't worry, bullets aren't about to shoot out of it.
Colonel Sanders took a huge furoshiki cloth from a pocket and handed it to Hoshino.
Wrap it up in this, better for people not to see it.
I told you it was stealing!
Are you deaf? It's not stealing. We need it for something important, so we're just borrowing it for a while.
Okay. Okay. I get it. Following the rules of dramaturgy,
We're of necessity moving matter.
Precisely, Colonel said, nodding. See, you do understand what I'm talking about.
Carrying the stone wrapped in the navy blue cloth, Hoshino followed the path back out of the woods, Colonel Sanders lighting the way for him with his torch. The stone was much heavier than it looked, and he had to stop a few times to catch his breath. They quickly cut across the well-lit shrine grounds so no one would see them, then came out on a main street. Colonel Sanders hailed a taxi and waited for Hoshino to climb in with the stone.
"So I should put it next to my pillow, eh?" Hoshino asked.
"Right," Colonel Sanders said. "That's all you have to do. Don't try anything else. Just having it there's the main thing."
"I should thank you for showing me where the stone was."
Colonel Sanders grinned.
"No need. Just doing my job. Just consummating my function. But hey, how about that girl, Hoshino?"
"She was amazing."
"I'm glad to hear it.
She was real, right? Not a fox spirit or some abstraction or something messed up like that?"
"No spirit, no abstraction. Just one real, live sex machine. Genuine four-wheel drive lust. It wasn't easy to find her, so rest assured."
"Phew," Hoshino sighed.
By the time Hoshino laid the cloth-wrapped stone next to Nakata's pillow, it was already past 1 a.m. He thought that putting it next to Nakata's pillow instead of his own lessened the chance of any curse. As he'd expected, Nakata was still out like the proverbial log. Hoshino untied the cloth so the stone was visible. He changed into his pajamas, crawled into the other futon, and fell instantly asleep. He had one short dream. Of a god in shorts, hairy shins sticking out, racing around a field, playing a flute. At 5 that morning, Nakata woke up and found the stone beside his pillow.
31. Just after 1 o'clock, I take coffee up to the first floor study. The door, as always, is open. Miss Saiki's standing by the window, gazing out. One hand resting on the windowsill. Lost in thought, unaware that her other hand's fingering the buttons on her blouse. This time, there's no pen or writing paper on the desk. I put the coffee cup on the desk. A thin layer of cloud covers the sky, and the birds outside are quiet for a change. She finally notices me, and, pulled back from her thoughts, comes away from the window, sits at the desk, and takes a sip of coffee. She motions for me to sit in the same chair as yesterday. I sit down and look at her across the desk, sipping her coffee. Does she remember anything at all about what happened last night? I can't tell. She looks as though she knows everything, and at the same time, like she doesn't know a thing. Images of her naked body come to mind, memories of how different parts felt. I'm not even sure that it was the body of the woman who's here in front of me. At the time, though, I was 100% sure. She has on a light green, silky-looking blouse, and a tight beige skirt. There's a thin silver necklace at her throat, very chic. Like some neatly crafted object, her slim fingers on the desk are beautifully intertwined. "So, do you like this part of the world now?" she asks me. "Do you mean Takamatsu?" "Yes." "I don't know. I haven't seen much of it. Just a few things along the way. This library, of course, a gym, the station, the hotel, those kinds of places. Don't you find it boring?" I shake my head. "I don't know yet. I haven't had time to get bored. And cities look the same anyway." "Why do you ask? Do you think it's a boring town?" She gives a slight shrug. "When I was young, I did. I was dying to get away. To leave here and go someplace else where something special was waiting. Where I could find more interesting people." "Interesting people?" Miss Saiki shakes her head slightly. I was young, she says. Most young people have that feeling, I suppose. Haven't you? No. I never felt that, if I went somewhere else, there would be special things waiting for me. I just wanted to be somewhere else, that's all. Anywhere but there. There? Nogata, Nakano Ward, where I was born and grew up. At the sound of this name, something flashes across her eyes. At least it looks like it. As long as you left there, you didn't particularly care where you went, she asks. That's right, I say. Where I went wasn't the issue. I had to get away from there, or else I knew I'd be totally messed up. So I left. She looks down at her hands resting on the desk, a detached look in her eyes. Then very quietly, she says, When I left here, when I was 20, I felt the same way. I had to leave, or I wouldn't survive. And I was convinced I'd never see this place again as long as I lived. I never considered coming back, but things happened, and here I am. As if I'm starting all over again. She turns round and looks out of the window. The clouds covering the sky are the same tone as before, and there isn't any wind to speak of. The whole thing looks as still as the painted background scenery in a film. Incredible things happen in life, she says. You mean I might go back to where I started? I don't know. That's up to you, sometime well in the future. But I think where a person is born and dies is very important. You can't choose where you're born, but where you die you can, to some degree. She says all this in a soft voice, staring out of the window, like she's talking to some imaginary person outside. Remembering I'm here, she turns towards me. I wonder why I'm confessing all these things to you. Because I'm not from around here, and our ages are so different. I suppose that's it, she says. For 20, maybe 30 seconds, we're lost in our own thoughts. She picks up her cup and takes another sip of coffee. I decide to come right out and say it. Miss Saiki, I have something I need to confess too. She looks at me and smiles. We're exchanging secrets, I see. Mine isn't a secret, just a theory. A theory, she repeats. You're confessing a theory? Yes. Sounds interesting. It's a sequel to what we were talking about, I say. What I mean is, did you come back to this town to die? Like a silvery moon at dawn, a smile rises to her lips. Perhaps I did. But it doesn't seem to matter. Whether you come to a place to live or to die, the things you do every day are much the same. Are you hoping to die? I wonder, she says. I don't know myself. My father was hoping to die. Your father died. Not long ago, I tell her. Very recently, in fact. Why? Was your father trying to die? I take a deep breath. For a long time, I couldn't work it out. But now I think I have. After coming here, I finally understand. Why? My father was in love with you, but couldn't get you back. Or maybe from the very beginning he couldn't really make you his. He knew that, and that's why he wanted to die. And that's also why he wanted his son, your son, too, to murder him. Me, in other words. He wanted me to sleep with you and my older sister, too. That was his prophecy, his curse. He programmed all of this in me. Miss Saiki returns her coffee cup to the saucer with a hard, neutral sound. She looks straight at me, but she's not really seeing me. She's staring at some void,
some blank space elsewhere. Do I know your father? I shake my head. As I told you, it's just a theory. She rests her hands on the desk, one on top of the other. Faint traces of a smile remain. In your theory, then, I'm your mother. That's right, I say. You lived with my father, had me, and then went away, leaving me behind. In the summer, when I'd just turned 4. So that's your theory? I nod. Which explains why you asked me yesterday whether I have any children. Again, I nod. I told you I couldn't answer that. Couldn't give you a yes or a no. I know. So your theory remains speculative. I nod again. That's right. So tell me, how did your father die? He was murdered. You didn't murder him, did you? No, I didn't. I have an alibi. But you're not entirely sure. I shake my head. I'm not sure at all. She lifts the coffee cup again and takes a tiny sip, as if it has no taste. Why did your father put you under that curse? He must have wanted me to take over his will, I say. To desire me, you mean? That's right, I say. Miss Psyche stares into the cup in her hand, then looks up again. So do you? Desire me? I give one clear nod. She closes her eyes. I gaze at her closed eyelids for a long time, and through them I can see the darkness that she's seeing. Odd shapes loom in it, floating up, only to disappear. Finally, she opens her eyes. You mean, in theory, you desire me? No, apart from the theory. I want you, and that goes way beyond any theory. You want to have sex with me? I nod. She narrows her eyes, as if something's shining in them. Have you ever had sex with a girl before? I nod again. Last night, with you, I think. But I can't say it out loud. She doesn't remember a thing. Something close to a sigh escapes her lips. Kafka, I know you realize this, but you're 15, and I'm more than 50. It's not that simple. We're not talking about that sort of time here. I know you when you were 15, and I'm in love with you at that age. Very much in love. And through her, I'm in love with you. That young girl's still inside you, asleep inside you. Once you go to sleep, though, she comes to life. I've seen it. She closes her eyes once more, her eyelids trembling faintly. I'm in love with you, and that's what's important. I think you understand that. Like someone rising to the surface of the sea from the depths below, she takes a deep breath. She searches for the words to say, but they lie beyond her grasp. I'm sorry, Kafka, but would you mind leaving? I'd like to be alone for a while, she says, and close the door on your way out. I nod, stand up, and start to go, but something pulls me back. I stop at the door, turn round and walk across the room to where she is. I reach out and touch her hair. Through the strands, my hand brushes her small ear. I just can't help it. Miss Saiki looks up surprised, and after a moment's hesitation, lays her hand on mine. At any rate, you and your theory are throwing a stone at a target that's very far away. Do you understand that? I nod. I know. But metaphors can reduce the distance.